Ethereum as a pure settlement layer is likely how things are going to trend because the demand for block space is so much higher than supply. And so layer twos can fulfill that demand. But then it means if you want to transact directly on Ethereum, your transaction is competing against layer two block transactions, where the kind of the purchasing power of a layer two block is going to be substantially higher than a single individual. The more layer twos come on stream, the less likely it is that people will be directly transacting with Ethereum.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, everyone. My name is Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I'm with Zach, the co-founder and CEO of Aztec. How's it going?
GM, indeed. It's going well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Of course. It was great seeing you in London in the new office. Congratulations on the London office.
Thanks. It's been a surreal...
Very exciting times right now.
Oh, yes. Yes, things are really heating up. We moved into a new office because we've grown a little bit. This is a real big year for us. We've been going for 6 years now, which makes us geriatric by Web3 standards, I believe. This is kind of the breakout year for Aztec, where we're developing the final form of our technology and producing a fully programmable, privacy-first layer 2 for Ethereum, and excited to bring that into the world.
Yes, very exciting. It's hopefully the future of blockchain privacy. Just for the people that are unfamiliar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Who the hell am I? Good question. I'm Zach. I am the CEO and co-founder of Aztec, which is a privacy layer 2 for Ethereum. My background is, what the hell is my background these days? I started out as a particle physicist. Then I didn't want to do, academia wasn't for me. I became a programmer. And then I decided to try the entrepreneur thing by doing a startup. And I got into blockchain. And then I somehow fell into cryptography and became a cryptographer. And now I'm a CEO. That's about it. It's been a varied path to get here.
Definitely. Particle physicist to now entrepreneur, programmer, cryptography. Very interesting. So how did you break into cryptography? How did you go from particle physicists, to cryptography? It seems like a drastically different thing.
Yeah, it is, very much so. So I left academia for a variety of reasons, but largely just wasn't for me. I found that out quite late, that I wanted to do something a bit less esoteric with my life, something a bit more tangible. So I got into cryptography through necessity. It wasn't really through interest. So flashback to 27, I just co-founded a startup called Credit Mint with a friend of mine, Tom Pocock. And we're doing TradFi on Ethereum. So we're trying to do corporate loans, syndicated loans, basically large institutional clients borrowing money. Not the sexiest obvious cases, but at the time, it looked very practical. And in 2017, that was really interesting to me because that was the year of, the ICO boom and a lot of speculative, weird use cases of blockchain. And I was like, it was Tom's idea. I thought, Tom's idea is it's got legs, it's got teeth. But when you're trying to put, multi-billion portfolios on chain, you kind of need privacy because it's just, for many, many reasons, you need strong privacy guarantees. And back then, I was very naive about, I thought, if you just split up your transactions into lots of little chunks and, spread them around the blockchain, you should be able to hide it. And it took until the winter of 2017, it dawned on me and Tom just how much of a problem we had on our hands with actually getting privacy guarantees on chain, without actually genuinely being able to hide key information required for transactions to execute. So I started looking into cryptography because I'm like, well, I really enjoy this startup thing. I like doing what I do. I don't want to go back to my old job. So for me, it was basically, do or die. I had to solve this privacy problem. So I started looking into zero-knowledge cryptography. And my physics background helped because I had that fluency with mathematics. And I kind of became addicted to crypto because I didn't really appreciate it before I'd studied it. Just how impressive it is that you can prove statements about encrypted information. I can give you some random scrambled garbage that looks like nothing, but I can still prove that somehow under the hood, if you were to decrypt it, it would contain certain properties, for example, like digital signatures, passwords, stuff like that. And And so I realized that if you've paired this with a distributed ledger, then you know you really do unlock a tremendous potential, because you solve one of the critical vulnerabilities of distributed ledgers, which is that everything has to be transparent. That is not how we conduct ourselves in our day-to-day lives. And if we're trying to create technological infrastructure that can replace existing industries, existing technologies, most of those technologies require some kind of user privacy guarantees, are simply needed for Web3 to compete on a level playing field. So I became addicted to cryptography. I had some wonderful influences in my journey. I was connected with Jens Groth, who is one of the OG cryptos in the space. He basically invented something called pairing-based cryptography, which is extremely foundational. And he was very kind enough to effectively mentor me and teach me the ropes. So with his help, I managed to produce a cryptography protocol which solved Credit's privacy problem. But then we realized very quickly that what we had on our hands was much more lucrative than just for Credit, and that it was worth pivoting to becoming a infrastructure provider to provide privacy-preserving technologies for chain in general. So that's what we did, and we pivoted Credit into Aztec.
Very interesting background. Such a great backstory. Wow. Okay, so let's run through Aztec real quick.
Sure thing.
At a high level, what is it? And then we'll break down each minute part of it.
Okay, so at a high level, I'm going to talk about what I want Aztec to accomplish. So if you have a smart contract, your smart contract has a bunch of variables. They can do things like record token balances or certificates or identities. And you have a bunch of functions that can operate on those variables. So these defines transactions. You can define, you know, cryptocurrencies, you can define NFTs, you can define identity documents, you can define games, you can define anything you want that contains some kind of value, but you want some single source of truth that defines like who owns these assets you're creating. What do I want to do? I want that information to be private. I want that information to be able to be structured such that, you know, you get all the benefits of a programmable network like Ethereum, but you don't splash that information all over the internet whenever you make a transaction. Effectively, private programmable money, I guess you could say. So tactically, what does this look like? So Aztec is a layer two. Specifically, we're a ZK rollup. So the idea is, instead of sending transactions to a network like Ethereum, you send them to a layer two like Aztec. And then what happens is block producers will construct a proof of correctness of the entire block and send that proof to the Ethereum network. These validity proofs effectively massively increase the amount of transactions that you can put through a network, because now you don't have a scenario where every single Ethereum node has to manually evaluate every transaction in an Aztec block. They just have to verify the proof, and that's very efficient. So that's one cornerstone of Aztec. But the other one, that doesn't give you privacy, that just gives you scalability. The privacy aspect comes from the fact that every Aztec transaction is itself a zero-knowledge proof. So if I'm a user and I want to transact with the Aztec network, so I wanted to, you know, send a token or interact with some DeFi protocol, I won't send, unlike Ethereum, where for Ethereum, you send an instruction to the transaction network that records what you want to do. So you want to, you know, you want to send a transaction to a certain contract. With Aztec, you construct a proof. Basically, you evaluate that transaction locally and construct a proof of correctness that says, well, here's what's going to happen effectively. So here's, like, you have some state that's associated with your account. So you say, here's some input state, here's some output state, it's all encrypted, so you don't know what's going on, you don't even know which account it belongs to, but you send a proof, a zero-knowledge proof that proves that you follow the rules of the network. And so using that, and I am massively oversimplifying here, but using those kinds of techniques, you can provide strong privacy guarantees to users, because everything is end-to-end encrypted, but you still have these mathematical proofs that prove that the rules of the network were followed, so that the smart contracts that have been you're interacting with one or more of the smart contracts that have been deployed to the network.
And are the smart contracts checking that proof is legit?
The protocol does. So the idea is that the smart contracts themselves are ZK SNARK circuits. And the Aztec protocol is also a bunch of SNARK circuits. But the Aztec protocol SNARK circuits validate that the smart contract proofs that you've provided are correct. And then you send a proof of the Aztec protocol circuits to the Aztec network. Let me try to step back up, because I'm kind of diving into the weeds here. Privacy is a bit of a nebulous term. And in reality, there's really three types of privacy in a blockchain network. You have user privacy, which is hiding who is transacting, who the message sender is. Okay. You have data privacy, which is like what information are you updating in the blockchain? For example, like account balances or you know, token ownerships. Like is that data hidden? So observers can't see what's going on. And then you have function privacy, which is where you don't even know which smart contracts are being called in a given transaction. And via the use of ZK SNARKs and zero knowledge proofs, ASIC provides all three privacy guarantees.
Very interesting. I remember Madaya talking about this before, one of the past episodes. He was talking about, I think we're discussing MEV and the high level of ASIC as well. How you can do, I think if I remember correctly, it might be different now, but you have transactions that you can see data and some that you cannot see data. Is that correct still?
That is correct. So ASIC is a hybrid system where what I described is an end-to-end encrypted transaction on ASIC. But the nature of privacy adds an extra complication, because if data is private, that means it's encrypted.
Right.
And therefore has an owner. The owner is somebody who holds the decryption key. So you can use multi-party computation techniques to give an encrypted object multiple owners, but that number is going to be small. Mm-hmm. And so that presents a problem with things like DeFi, because if you have something like a Uniswap protocol, then you have liquidity pools, and every transaction updates those liquidity pools. And you need to know the sizes of those liquidity pools to perform things like price matching, price computation. So that's global state, effectively, and that's not owned by anyone. And so how do you make that private? Well, there's many ways you can try to do this, but we think that you can get the best of both worlds by creating a hybrid platform where, for protocols that are more DeFi-oriented, those protocols are public. But the way I describe it is privacy for the user, transparency of the protocol. So all information about a user, so who they are, what they own, etc., that's all private. But but protocols that operate on user interactions can be are public. So the way this would work is, for example, in Uniswap, the tokens going through Uniswap would all be public, like the values, the prices, but the owners of those tokens would be hidden.
I remember this. Okay, interesting. And since we're on the topic of, you know, this cryptography stuff, you mentioned ZK SNARKs. Well, we can get into that.
All right. So let's see. Starting at the bottom, you have the cryptography stack, which is basically the zero knowledge proving system. So we call it Honk. It's a combination of multiple cryptography protocols. We have the Honk zero knowledge proving system, which is derivative of Plonk. We have Goblin Plonk. One of the key innovations of Plonk is basically providing several abstraction layers that one can use, or defining several abstraction layers that one can use to build these ZK SNARKs. Mm-hmm. They're made of three systems. So fundamentally, what we're trying to do is we're converting computer programs, so imperative statements, into polynomial equations. Why are we doing this? It's because we know we have ways of efficiently proving in zero knowledge the correctness of polynomial equations. Basically, you could hide some of the inputs. The way we do this is, okay, so the first step one, you have this concept of circuit arithmetization. So this is where you take, it's a technique of converting some high-level imperative programming, like program structure, into polynomial algebra. And so generally, this will be in the form of things like converting your program into arithmetic gates, like addition gates, multiplication gates, which you can then convert into a formula over polynomials. And by polynomials, basically, well, the next step of it is something called a polynomial commitment scheme. Basically, it's a way of encoding an enormous amount of information into a polynomial equation and then providing a succinct representation of that polynomial. You may have a polynomial with a million terms in it, which is effectively going to we use polynomials to encode vectors. So that basically means I got a vector of a million terms. That's going to be a polynomial with a degree size of 1 million. And I want to represent that with a very small amount of information, a few hundred bytes at best. The utility of polynomial commitment schemes is that you can, it's kind of a way of compressing information that preserves some of its properties. Because if you provide a commitment to a polynomial, then given like mainstream polynomial commitment schemes, what happens with them is then you can then, given any kind of evaluation point, you can provide the evaluation of that polynomial and a very small proof that that evaluation is correct without having to have the verifier perform extremely intensive computations over these giant polynomials.
That's a very interesting 1 million, like let's say 1 million terms, and it goes into like 100 bytes. That's incredible.
Oh, it is. It really is. I mean, like the most efficient proving system when it comes to proof size is something called Groth 16 from Jens Groth, my old mentor, who the proofs are 128 bytes, and you can fit billions of constraints. So you're talking about like vectors with billions and billions of terms in them.
Oh my God.
Tiny little piece of information. It's very impressive. The final missing piece, the third component in a SNARK, is this concept of a polynomial interactive oracle proof, which is kind of the meat of a SNARK. What a PIOP does is It is a cryptographic protocol run between a so-called prover and a verifier. But in our case, the verifier is either a smart contract or another ZK Snark program.
Right.
Where basically the prover will wants to prove that some giant equation over polynomials is equal to zero. And this implies that all of your kind of your arithmetic gates in your circuit are satisfied. And what it does is it's a protocol that converts a test about whether a polynomial relation is zero into a test about whether evaluations of that polynomial are zero. So, for example, instead of checking a of x times b of x minus c of x equals zero, you generate some random point alpha, and you check a of alpha times b of alpha minus c of alpha right. equals zero. And the latter check is much easier to do because then if your polynomials have billions of terms in them, then well, the evaluation of those polynomials is just a single term. Mm. So the idea is that you run a polynomial, you commit your polynomials, you run a polynomial into metaphorical proof, reduce your basically checking every constraint. Every gate in your circuit is satisfied to checking a single relation over evaluated polynomials, and then you use your polynomial commitment scheme to provide the verifier with evaluations of those polynomials so that the verifier can efficiently test the relation is correct. It's kind of hard to explain in just words. There's a wonderful blog article called Plonk by Hand, which by David Wong, which explains the Plonk ZK Snark very, very efficiently. I highly recommend it.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. And when... That's okay. So you're saying that the commitment scheme goes to your interactive oracle proof, and then the commitment scheme goes to like the prover to verify. How do these provers actually verify?
Oh, no, the provers don't verify. The provers send construct proofs that the verifier then check. The idea is that for example, take Noir. Noir is our programming language that we use to convert programs to circuits. If you write a Noir program, it's going to spit out a verifier smart contract, which is basically just the algorithm that runs that will check that your proof is correct. And it's going to do all of these components I just mentioned. It's going to run the polynomial interactive proof. It's going to evaluate the polynomial commitment scheme. It's going to evaluate polynomial relations.
Okay.
Either accept your proof or reject it.
Interesting. What are the InfoSec security things to consider with all of these, actually? Cryptography security seems quite interesting.
It is. And the attack surface is very vast, because what a zero knowledge proof does is it guarantees that your proof is basically impossible. It's computationally unfeasible to fake a proof. So basically, unless you have a quantum computer, then you need to run you need all the computational power that the humanity possesses running until the heat death of the universe to fake a proof. So okay. It's not feasible. And some of the proving systems around today are also quantum secure. However, that's making a few assumptions. The first of them is there are several cryptographic assumptions around where we assume certain computational operations are hard to perform. Mm-hmm. And if those assumptions are wrong, then the cryptography isn't secure. You then have assumptions around the actual, like you assume that the cryptography paper hasn't got any flaws in it. Nobody's infallible. For example, the paper that Zcash was based around had a flaw in it, which rendered it insecure briefly. And then you've also got to assume the implementation of your cryptography is secure. There isn't a bug that, the actual, your code lines up with mathematics in the paper. Mm-hmm. And the kind of the attack surface here is extremely large. Our cryptographic backend has got, 100,000 lines of code, which all needs to be audited. So that's rather difficult as well. You then have the issue of have you correctly converted your program into the constraints, basically. There's a class of bug in ZK Snark called an under constraints bug, which is where you think you're constraining parts of your program, and you actually aren't. It's very easy to make these kinds of mistakes. And it's a new class of bug you don't really find in traditional programming.
How do you identify this bug?
I mean, the best technique is fuzzing, to basically. You can fuzz. Other than that, it's just audits and a lot of code review.
Okay. What exactly is happening with this bug?
So the bug is a subtle type of bug. One of them, so where, for example, let's say you're doing some basic accounting in a program, right? So you have a balance and you're subtracting a value from that balance to produce a new balance. So one bug would be you don't check for integer underflow.
Okay.
In a Snark circuit, quite easily if you're not careful. Because you need to do a bunch of range checks, and if you don't apply those range checks, then your circuit is under constrained, basically, because you haven't checked for that underflow. That's one example. It's just those types of issues are much more common in Snark circuits than they are in regular programs.
Okay, got you. What actually makes the cryptography scheme. Is that correct terminology? Quantum resistant.
Quantum resistant. Well, it depends on the underlying cryptographic primitives you're using. So, for example, the technology we're using, it is fundamentally based on elliptic curves. And we know that elliptic curves are not quantum resistant, as in there are algorithms that exist that we know of that, if a sufficiently advanced quantum computer existed, could run these algorithms and basically break a lot of the elliptic curve cryptography that's being used. However, there are some primitives that we don't believe are currently affected by quantum computers. So, for example, a lot of hash-based schemes, so things like SHA-256, SHA-3, Blake-3, things like STARKs and the kinds of SNARKs that are used in software like Plonky 2 and Plonky 3, they use it like hashes as their basic cryptographic primitive, and so they are secure against quantum computers, but they also have other trade-offs as well.
So these are hash-based.
Yeah.
And before we started, you mentioned also folding schemes.
Yeah.
What are they?
So a folding scheme is a way of, it's a proxy for something we call recursion. So recursion is basically, if you imagine you have a ZK-SNARK circuit, and within that circuit, you want to run the verification algorithm for a ZK-SNARK protocol. So you're verifying a proof, kind of inside a proof. That's recursion. And it's a famously hard problem. And folding schemes are quite an elegant way of tackling it, where you, instead of like directly verifying proofs inside proofs inside proofs, you have a very elegant way of effectively like combining multiple proofs into a single proof.
Like using, concatenating proofs in some way.
Yeah, sort of. It's a bit like using random linear combinations. It's basically you take two like circuit descriptions and you kind of multiply them by some randomness and combine them together. I'm not explaining it that well, but there are techniques that allow you to do that in a way that preserves the structure of this circuit such that if you verify the folded proof, doing so implicitly means that all of the circuits that were folded into that object were correctly satisfied. So these schemes are like sit a layer above the ZK-SNARK protocol. So we use something called Protogate, and we use it to fold honk instances. And so honk is a derivative of plonk.
Oh, okay. Okay, so now that we've touched on the cryptography in the stack, what else is in the stack?
Let's go a step above that, and we have Noir. So Noir is our language frontend that we use to write circuits. It compiles to an intermediate representation, we call ASIR, Abstract Circuit Intermediate Representation, and that gets converted by our cryptography backend into SNARK circuits. And this is what allows like circuits to be written by engineers and not cryptographers, because it's a nice Rust-based language with clear, clean syntax. We then have our protocol circuits that are written in Noir. So these are the circuits that define what the ASIC protocol is doing. It's a bit like writing a chunk of the Geth client as a SNARK circuit. And so our protocol circuits evaluate the correctness of user transactions, and then they also aggregate multiple user transactions together inside a rollup. Then above that, we have our ASIC node. So it's a bit like, well, the rest of Geth that isn't in the protocol, that isn't in the protocol circuits. So it can be run by node operators. It creates a peer-to-peer transaction network. It can produce blocks. It syncs to the network. It exposes an RPC interface that can be used to extract information from the network. And within the node, we also have something we call the PXE, Private Execution Environment. So this is a encapsulated part of the node, which handles users' private state, which is quite... So if you consider something like a MetaMask. If you want to send a transaction to the Ethereum network, you don't run a node personally. I mean, almost never. You will be interacting with a wallet like MetaMask, which will be talking to Infura, which is an infrastructure provider that runs nodes on the behalf of users. You can't do that completely with Aztec because you can do that for everything except the private parts of Aztec, because in your state as a user, you don't want to be decrypting that on some server you don't control unless you're comfortable leaking information. So the private execution environment is the part of the Aztec node that contains user secrets that has to run client side. So it's an extremely minimal component of the node, but a very important one with very important security properties. We also have an Aztec virtual machine. So this isn't even something I've touched on yet. I mentioned before we have this hybrid system where you have private state, but you also have public state that can be handled to create protocols like Uniswap, and transactions that involve calling public components of contracts will be executed within a virtual machine that must be proved. So we have a ZK-SNARK circuit that proves the correctness of our virtual machine execution. So that's, we call it the AVM, Aztec Virtual Machine. That's another giant component of our technology stack. where else do we go from here? So we
cover
then
the node,
have
cover the AVM.
Yeah. So we have the sequencer network. So we need a network of entities that will actually produce Aztec blocks and to be able to coordinate them, as in who gets to produce an Aztec block. We use effectively proof of stake via Ethereum. You know, you stake on Ethereum, but that all needs to be sequenced. And
is that decentralized?
It is decentralized, yes.
So anyone can become a sequencer, and it's kind of like block building on Ethereum?
Yeah, yeah. So we have this kind of block builder separation. So the idea is some random entity can propose a block to be made, and the sequencers are the ones that are actually making that block, and they have the right to do that because they're staking tokens on Ethereum or staking something of value, and the more that is staked, the greater your likelihood is of being selected as a sequencer. So we have a whole sequencer proposer protocol called Finet as well to handle this.
When someone creates a block as a sequencer, let's say they're chosen, how does this land on Ethereum?
Well, it lands on Ethereum. So the sequencer will, because they'll be running an Aztec node, they will have access to the Aztec peer-to-peer transaction network. So they'll basically extract transactions that they want to build a block out of from that network. And then that block, once they've made it, needs to be proved, because it's the proof that gets sent to the Ethereum network. And this is where a proven network comes in. So the idea is that the sequencer doesn't make the proof themselves, because you need a lot of computational resources to make that block proof, and we don't want that to be a barrier for running a sequencer. Also, there's lots of third-party prover networks that are being produced now to provide proving as a service, so we're just going to outsource proof construction to those networks. So we don't really define in protocol how the proofs are made, just that some entity needs to make them.
There's an entity that creates the block, there's an entity that proves the block, and if I'm a builder, if I'm building a block, I want to make the best block possible, right?
Yeah.
Can you actually see account balances, transfers, any of that, swaps?
You can see the public components, but not the private components, which means that it does limit some of the MEV on that's available, which, you know, is nice. But there is still going to be MEV because of the public components. So,
which would be like the account balances, right?
Well, not necessarily reserves. Account balances. It'll be protocol balances. So you'll be able to see inflows and outflows from Uniswap. But you won't know who's doing it, but you'll know that they are occurring and therefore will be able to extract.
Without knowing the reserves of a pool, you can't really do a swap, right?
Well, you can with multi-party computations or fully homomorphic encryption. That's another kettle of fish.
We did that with Xamarin. With Rand a few weeks ago. That was very interesting. So then you have this block, you send it to a prover, and then what happens with the prover? How does it go from there to like an Ethereum validator to actually become a block?
Well, the prover, once the proof is made, the proof goes back to the sequencer, and the sequencer constructs an Ethereum transaction that gets sent to the Aztec rollup smart contract.
Oh, so it lands as just a single transaction.
I see what you're saying. Well, yeah, not technically. So we're likely going to be doing a block. Will likely can be multiple transactions, just so that we're not bottlenecked by data. Because we may want to, for blocks that are particularly large, we may want to include the information in that block, like that block contains, across multiple EIP 4844 blobs. But it can kind of be abstracted away as a single transaction. As in, you know, if the Ethereum block space was large enough, it would just be one transaction.
So it could be multi-block on Ethereum to settle. So it's like kind of asynchronous then, in that sense.
Well, it's not necessarily asynchronous as it is lower latency. So the settlement time for Aztec is not going to be one Ethereum block. It'll likely be multiple Ethereum blocks.
And that's filling the entire block, or just like maybe one or two transactions in each block?
Yeah, we're not going to be filling the entire Ethereum block space. Yeah, not at all.
Interesting. Because I'm thinking like you could probably do some cross-domain stuff right there if you're running a sequencer but also a builder.
Yep.
It's very interesting.
It is, yeah. This is where these kind of shared sequencing networks ideas are cropping up, because, you know, if you have lots of networks with lots of blocks being built, then if you have eyes on all of the block state that's being updated, you can make much more profitable blocks.
Yeah, and I think the decentralized version of that is, well, kind of essential, but you don't want any centralized party. And this will be, this entire network will be completely decentralized as well, right?
Yep, that's the plan. So day one on launch, we'll launch it decentralized.
Very, very exciting. It's This is something I'm quite curious about, because this is obviously groundbreaking, revolutionary technology where if it's completely decentralized and you don't know who's trading what, I mean, what's going to happen with governments, right? It's something that completely shuts them down.
Yes. Yeah, so it is a very good question. And there's a spectrum of views on this, from the Monero burn it to the ground view to more conservative views. Here's the thing, right? Like, privacy is, in my opinion, very misunderstood as a technology in this space, because previously the technology has not really been sufficiently advanced to do anything more than basic cryptocurrency mixes. But here's the thing about privacy. If you have privacy on a blockchain network, that means you can link an identity to a cryptocurrency account. You know, you can link things like passports, social security numbers, bank details, proofs of address, et cetera, et cetera. And you can do that because it's all encrypted. And so therefore, you know, you're not leaking that information. And right. If you can do that, then paradoxically, it does actually allow you to create financial systems where you have a lot more ability to distinguish between good and bad actors. Because right. you can create preemptive checks where, like, you know, in order to, for example, use an off-ramp to an exchange, then, you know, you must possess a KYC token from that exchange. And that whole interaction can be performed completely privately. So no one knows that you possess such a token, but you can still prove that you have it. Or similarly, you know, you can use a signature from a passport to prove that you are a citizen of a certain country, and therefore that you're not violating, you know, certain sanctions regimes. If you can prove your identity, you can prove you're not on an OFAC list. You know, you can, if you can link identities to cryptocurrency accounts, that gives you uniqueness checks, which means you can do things like transfer limits. So you can prove that right. you've not spent more than like $50,000 or something in a certain currency, which means you can prove that you do not need to undergo certain compliance checks because you're under some kind of threshold. So I do think that there is going to be a organic evolution of these kind of identity protocols on Aztec. Right. That can be used to distinguish between good and bad actors. And so the way we think about it as a network is we want to be able to provide the tools and technologies that allow application developers to be compliant in the regime they're located in. But we want to be neutral about it, and we do not want to mandate such tools are used because that would require placing a centralized nexus of control on the network, and then it's no longer decentralized. Definitely. And yeah. So I think that the idea that these are going to be these are going to be black markets and, you know, bad, like places for bad actors to congregate. I don't believe that. And if I thought that Aztec was going to be used, that's how Aztec was going to be used, I wouldn't be building Aztec. Building Aztec because I can see that what we want to do is create a global marketplace for assets, programmable money. So anything which are in the real world, which has some kind of perceived value, if you can create a digital fingerprint of it on Aztec, that tracks on the real world assets where the owners of that asset are identified, not by just by a cryptocurrency account, but through other like real world links, then you create a very dynamic world where you don't have all of these like these fiefdoms of assets and money like spread around with the traditional banking system in all these different jurisdictions, and it really becomes a much more dynamic environment where the barriers to entry to providing these kind of financial services, it's the whole becoming unbanked hypothesis in a way that I think is much more achievable. But that's just one angle to it. You know, that's the Aztec as money angle, but there's also far more to it than that, because there's a lot of fundamental value around being able to prove things about data you hold, so that data can stay with you and doesn't have to be given to servers that can then be sold to data brokers.
Yeah, I completely agree. And especially in like healthcare, for example,
yes,
with what, you know, Xamarin AI is doing with Rand Hindi, the homomorphic encryption, they can use that private data and all the hospitals can share, you know, this, you know, the medical records without actually linking it to anyone and train an AI to help do stuff with that. And you can do that with everything that's related to whatever. And it guarantees privacy between the hospitals, but they all benefit from it and society benefits from it completely, which is very interesting use case. And hopefully like it gets adopted quite quickly, you know, and waiting promptly for the Aztec release, when mainnet.
We're working hard on it. We're working on our testnet currently. Yeah. So, I mean, our development prototype are a little longer than other layer 2s because we're launching fully decentralized. So our testnet's going to also be decentralized because, you know, Beautiful. The whole point of the testnet is to test the mainnet. But we're confident we can get that done this year, and that it's still early days. I'm confident that we'll get something out on the Ethereum mainnet, you know, early to mid-2025.
Okay, so I have a few questions with testing then. How do you actually test a blockchain?
How do you test a blockchain?
Well, step in a one, decentralized way.
Okay, so, well, first of all, we're doing in it, creating an internal testnet where the idea is, you know, it's the architecture and technology is decentralized. It's just that we internally run all of the nodes and all of the sequences. So we can see where things break.
You've got to run each part of the infrastructure to really test it.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And obviously, you know, like the way we're going about it, there's you can kind of mock out every core components, right? Like you can fake sequences, you can fake blocks, you can fake proofs. You can fake whatever you need to test one individual component while still getting some kind of end-to-end experience. But Definitely. The proof is, but you only truly test it when you have full end-to-end transactions. You only test it truly when you have a full decentralized testnet, because then that's when things like latency issues, coordination issues, they really start to become apparent. And I mean, it's not trivial, that's for sure.
Okay, on the topic of, you know, testing blockchains, what are your thoughts on, you know, the future of L2s and where blockchains going now? I was at an event before and they were talking about, you know, shared sequences and super builders, and I think the discussion of, you know, Ethereum is just now a settlement layer and everything else is just L2s. So what are your thoughts on this? Where do you see it going? Where do you hope to see it go?
Yeah, it's a complicated space, and predictions are always fraught with danger because usually they're wrong. But I will make some predictions. So I do think that the Ethereum as a pure settlement layer is likely how things are going to trend, because the demand for block space is so much higher than supply. And so layer twos can fulfill that demand. But then it means if you want to transact directly on Ethereum, your transaction is competing against layer two block transactions, where the kind of the purchasing power of a layer two block is going to be substantially higher than a single individual, which means that it's the more layer twos come on stream, the less likely it is that people will be directly transacting with Ethereum. That being said, I still see networks like Ethereum as being the place where fundamental value is represented. So if you have a token, you create it on Ethereum and then you bridge it into L2s. But the fundamental statement of who owns what is exactly. But also,
on the topic of that, just before we start with this one, on the topic of the L2s, all, like, let's say we had 100 L2s and they were all competing for the block space on just one block of Ethereum. Imagine if just like all the L2s just fizzle out because one is just providing so much more value.
It's a good question.
Then it would never really work as in like hundreds of, you know, and then thousands of L2s. It would just go to like a small amount.
Okay, I'm going to give a spicy take here. And that is that L2s have become a narrative in this industry in a similar way to how previously NFTs were a narrative and DeFi was a narrative. And before that, ICOs and tokens were a narrative. And these narratives provide compelling stories that one can use to effectively create, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but to create a meme coin effectively, where the idea is that why does the token have value? It doesn't have value because there's anything of fundamental economic utility that's being provided, but there is a compelling narrative that people are buying into, where they think that narrative is compelling enough that other people will buy in and buy the token and make the price go up. It's an absolute FOMO effect. And right now, layer twos are the FOMO effect. Before it was NFTs, then it was DeFi, then it was tokens and ICOs. And so, I mean, like, for example, you know, Barrachain. I love that project. They believe they recently raised $100 million. There's a lot to learn from them in terms of execution. But I don't think anyone can deny that they are a meme coin, but they're also a layer two. And there's a reason why they're a layer two. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't think this is going to last. I think that just like in evolution, no two species can occupy the same ecological niche without one out-competing the other and making the other extinct. In a similar way, no two products can occupy the same economic niche. So you have to provide some kind of unique value proposition. You have to provide some distinguishability. And there is absolutely scope for distinguishability between layer twos. I mean, we do privacy. That's a big factor for us. But there's also, you know, there's various spectrums where you can trade security for throughput. You can use different languages. You can have even maybe even like just different geographic communities. But there needs to be a difference between you and somebody else, another layer two. And if there isn't, one of you is going to die. And so I do suspect that 2025, 2026 is going to see a process of consolidation. On top of that, I think we're going to see the rise of something else. They've sometimes been called layer threes, but I don't think that's a very good word for it. Application-specific rollups. Because take a layer two, right? For a layer two, block space is still not going to be cheap, eventually. Like right now they are, but that's because they're being underutilized and EIP4844 is new, so not everyone's tapped into them. But if you want to create a world where you know you have throughputs of hundreds of thousands of transactions a second, there's going to be limited block space on layer twos because layer twos have properties that affect their throughput. Yep. They have censorship resistance, you have strong data availability guarantees, you have strong liveness guarantees. And for a lot of applications, you don't need all these three properties. Let's, for example, imagine you're an application vendor that handles micropayments on the internet. Okay. So you're doing something like Stripe or Vent, but for you know online websites using a browser extension. So let's say you've got a throughput of, you're doing hundreds of thousands of transactions a day, maybe 1,000 transactions a second, but they're all tiny amounts. And users trust you for small amounts, right? It's not like people are worried about you running off with their $10. So what are you going to do? You want, ideally, the benefit of a blockchain network because you care about composability with the world of assets on blockchain, and it provides a very convenient and efficient on and off ramp. And it basically is your transaction network. But you don't really need the data availability costs. You don't want to pay for the liveness guarantees. You don't want to pay for the censorship resistance. So what do? You run an application-specific rollup. You run a rollup. It could be the OP stack. It could be eventually we're going to be doing the ASIC stack. But it's one where it's configurable. So the idea is you don't have decentralized sequences. You're the sequencer. You don't have data availability. You know, your data is on your server. And it means that your throughput of your little mini network can be really, really fast. And then you create rollup blocks and you settle your rollup blocks on another layer too, like Aztec. And this provides a very decent compromise between between long-term security properties, which you do want to pay for, and the short-term where you don't really need the security properties on an hour-to-hour basis.
Right.
And so the difference between an application-specific rollup and a layer three is a bit subtle. They use the same technology, but an application-specific rollup is a layer three where you just have one dApp deployed to it. You don't have a diverse landscape of applications. It's being run by a specific application vendor for a specific purpose.
So it's kind of like the Cosmos ecosystem where each app is its own chain.
Yeah, it is. And I do see application-specific rollups. Once the tooling advances enough and the technology advances enough, I see those exploding in use.
You know, just to come back again to the narratives, I'm curious, how do you think these are actually created and what actually makes them become so volcanic?
I think it's the hype cycle, right? I mean, all these narratives are based around real utility, right? Why were ICO a compelling narrative? It's because it's a very efficient, pluralistic way of fundraising. Instead of having, you know, like if you're Joe Average, right? Like you don't get to invest in startups. You're not an accredited investor. Everything is, you know, you're kept out of those markets through a bunch of walls, ostensibly to protect you. In reality, maybe not. And the ICOs are is a very efficient way of raising capital.
So it's all based on the utility, and then backing that up with a story.
Yeah, so there is some nexus of value there. And similarly to why was DeFi a powerful narrative? Well, because it's useful. It's a radical new way of doing finance where you don't have centralized actors. It's going to be a big deal. It is a big deal. It's going to be more of a big deal in the future. And similarly, like NFTs, right? Like they're really powerful. The idea of having a digital fingerprint of that represents something, whether it's like a ticket or ownership of an asset, or even if it's just digital art, it's a compelling story. And similarly with layer twos, they solve one of the existential problems of blockchain, which is they don't scale very well. So it's a compelling narrative. And so they create their own hype cycles. And so at the peak, you're going to get a lot of people opportunistically using that narrative to kind of tack onto their project without it being fundamental to what they're doing. Right. And I'll tell you something, I suspect that one of the next cycles is going to be around privacy, if it hasn't already started. The Shiba Inu chain, I believe, raised a bunch of money to do privacy, which is...
Oh, really?
It's interesting, for sure. I look forward to competing with the dog
coin. With Shiba.
I do, yeah. I think we need to get with the times. We need to, you know, our logo is far too minimalistic. We need to turn it into something else, maybe like a
Pepe.
Pepe, yeah. Pepe, yeah. Maybe trains. I think trains are underutilized in the current current meme marketplace, but what do I know? I'm more a tech guy than a
I think Pepe for Pepe guy. Privacy.
Yeah. And I'm sure regulators will love that. Yes, Aztec is a legitimate core piece of decentralized financial infrastructure with a Pepe frog as its logo.
Bullish. Yes. That's a bull bullish. Signal.
It's a bull signal.
So just to come back to this point of the evolution with two different species competing for the same the same thing, right? Speaking of that, who are the competitors and
who are the
what
competitors?
Are they doing? There's no competitors right now?
I mean, no, there are. Okay. There's three kinds of competitors. There's privacy-focused L2s, there's privacy-focused L1s, and there's L2s that could eventually incorporate privacy into their tech stack.
Okay.
However, I don't see it as being very, very productive to focus on competitors. And that's because right now, this space is not PvP, it's PvE, the way I see it. Like, the market for what we're doing at the moment is absolutely tiny because the technology we're producing doesn't really yet exist in production in any meaningful way. So I could focus on like beating competition and getting more throughput than them, more transactions, but like I don't really care because what I care about is growing the market because the market is multiple orders of magnitude smaller than what it can be. And that's far more important. And so right now I think we are in a positive sum game where we all benefit from sharing technology, sharing research, sharing ideas, sharing innovation, because we're all trying to grow that pie. And right now that's far more productive and valuable than fighting over the pie.
100%. Yeah. So instead of trying to take it all, help others, and then the pie grows in general. And then indeed. There's more for your share. Perfect. And just for our final questions, two final questions actually. If someone wanted to get into math and get into cryptography and even to your level to, let's say, go to Aztec or do their own thing, how would you recommend they take that path to get to this level?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And honestly, I hate to be a bit wishy-washy. I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question because the path I took to where I am was was a rough path, basically, because I was learning about zero knowledge in 2018 when everything was much more primitive, much more undefined. The learning resources were much cruder. And so I can't in good faith recommend my path because my path was basically read cryptography stack exchange, read cryptography papers 18 hours a day, trying to glean some kind of understanding. If there's something you don't understand in a paper, but it references another paper, look at that reference.
Go look at that.
And basically follow the trail of references until you go back far enough that you actually understand something and then keep going. It was fun, but my God, it was not an efficient way of acquiring information, given what we know today. What would I recommend? I mean, I can recommend a few things.
We can even go back to just math in general, right?
Yeah, I mean, having some facility with prime fields, not like elliptic curves, understanding what hashes are. But generally, what would a starting point be? There's a book called Real World Cryptography by David Wong. It's very good. I'd recommend that. I'd recommend there is a Stanford course that's available for everybody. I think it's called Moog. It's run by Dan Bernay. It's a pretty intense introduction, ZKP-MOOC. It's a pretty intense introduction to zero knowledge. It is thorough. For something a bit lighter, if you just want to understand the space a bit better, I would highly recommend Anna Rose's ZK podcast.
Oh, yes. Yep.
It is. Definitely. Absolutely. And basically, everyone she has on the show, look at what they're doing. Look into them. Follow the trail of kind of references and connections. And also just search around for, there's a bunch of like awesome zero knowledge lists, which have a bunch of learning resources.
100%.
But yeah, that's about the best I can offer, I'm afraid.
What about for just math in general? Let's say someone is either hasn't really dabbled in math since like, let's say high school or college, and they're down the road doing engineering and they want to get into math. Because I know it's very difficult to get into this field if you've never done it before, or even if you've just had spent like years away from it. Any advice on that front?
It's a good question. So I'm not sure I can directly answer because I got my mathematics background from a physics undergraduate degree. Which is a slow way of doing it. You know, if you just want the mathematics background, I can't recommend spending 4 years in it doing physics. But I can give some general advice, which is don't get too bogged down on the maths, because if you want to understand everything about cryptography, about like all of the technologies that are being used today in Web3 from first principles, you're going to be studying for a very long time. Right. The trick is to build up abstraction layers. For example, elliptic curves. What do you need to know about an elliptic curve to use them in protocols? Well, not that much, actually. You need to understand group theory a little bit. You need to know what a group is. And you need to know that elliptic curves, there's an operation that we call the elliptic curve group operation, which forms a group under addition. Once you do that, then you basically, you can treat elliptic curve points like integers, effectively. You'll see in a lot of cryptography papers, when elliptic curve formulas are being described, they will often have numbers in square brackets. So like a square brackets for one, square brackets like surrounded by like in wrapping two. What that's basically saying is those are equivalence classes. This is saying this is an elliptic curve point that is equivalent to the integer one, or equivalent to integer two, or equivalent to some integer variable x. And you just treat them like integers. And you, like, so do you need to know what a pairing is to do pairing-based cryptography? Well, at a high level, yes, but you don't need to know how they work. I've implemented elliptic curve pairing algorithms, and I couldn't give you a good explanation of how they work because it wasn't relevant to my research, so I never bothered learning. So I guess it's like my advice would be try to build up abstraction layers. Often it can help to look at a cryptographic protocol and see kind of the math that is required and then going back and learning that, because like the ground, the mathematical grounding you need for to be a cryptographer, it's number field theory. But if I tell you, oh, go learn number field theory, you'll be lost in books for a year, learning far more than you actually need to just understand like the cryptanics that are used in Web3.
Got you. So learn the minimal amounts to actually apply it, basically.
Basically.
Interesting. And is there any, for the final question, any general advice for people in general?
In general, just...
life advice. Give us some life advice.
I'm a failed physicist and a cryptographer and an tech entrepreneur. I am not outside of those domains. I have no desire to give anyone any advice, I am afraid. Those are my expertises. So why is anyone listening to your podcast? They're probably interested in Web3. If you are, then you're already onto a good thing, because this is a very dynamic scene to be a part of, because blockchain is still an emerging technology. You know, there's still an enormous amount to discover and to apply that, you know, what we're going to be using as tech for in 3 decades will look nothing like what it's being used for today. So generally, a lot of the people that are attracted to this space are kind of people who don't really fit in to, you could say, the mainstream, right? Like people who maybe you've tried jobs in other careers, they just don't click with you. Like you get the sense of impending dread or doom about your life. You're like, I have to do something else. And you're here because blockchain is interesting. Now, I may be projecting a little bit. This isn't everyone, but I do think it covers a lot of people. And I guess where am I going with this? Basically, that this is a very special place in a very special moment in time that's going to not be here in 10 years. So make the most of it. You know, don't run away because it's scary and it's full of degenerates. There's gold in these hills if people are willing to dig to find it.
Definitely. Well, man, Zach, I appreciate the time very much. And I have learned a lot about cryptography. I was never really into it. And this was very interesting.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Very excited to see the future of Aztec and the future of your career as well. Probably we'll have you on later down the road for the mainnet.
Hopefully. And I look forward to it.
When privacy is the main narrative in the crypto scene, quite soon.
And call me out if that doesn't happen.
I'll call you out. Don't worry. I got you. Otherwise, it's been a pleasure, Zach. Thank you so much.
And, thank you for having me on.
Of course. And take care.
You too.